Hello, you're listening to a podcast by Speak Up Radio. Here, you'll get all the chat, insights and information, but you won't get any of the music, and that's because of how licensing works. To get the full experience, tune into the radio station 24/7 by visiting www.advocacyproject.org.uk/speakupradio. You are listening to Losing Myself, Mental Health in a Hostile Environment, a podcast brought to you by The Advocacy Project and Migrants Organise. Throughout this series, we hope to shine a light on the realities of the UK's immigration and asylum system, explore the pressure and anguish it puts upon people who go through it, while also hearing about hopeful and powerful acts of migrant and community organising. Each episode will focus on a different aspect of the UK's asylum system. On today's episode, we're joined by Irfan and Joe. Irfan is a community organiser, campaigner and refugee from Iran with recent experience of the UK's asylum process and the infamous Napier barracks. Joe Wilding has experience working as a barrister supporting migrants and refugees and now works as a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Brighton. We explore the feelings of powerlessness, dehumanisation and anxiety that people going through the UK's asylum and immigration system can experience, the importance of support and the struggles to find it when resources are thinly stretched and, once again, the power people can have when they organise. Hello, how are you both doing today?
Yeah, all right, thank you.
Yeah, it's a great day, thank you.
Would you both be able to introduce yourselves for the audience?
So I'm Irfan. I'm a former resident of Napier Barracks, and I've been active campaigning against the use of such accommodation as asylum accommodation since I've been there.
I'm Jo Wilding. I practiced as an immigration and asylum barrister for about 9 years at Garden Court Chambers in London, and then moved into research. So I was working at Brighton University doing some research on legal aid for immigration and asylum cases.
Thank you both. So Irfan, you've recently been through the UK's asylum process. What three words would you use to describe the experience?
It's really hard to fit in the experience into three words, but I would say probably limbo, depression and dehumanization. So yeah, I mean, when we talk about limbo, we have to consider that once people claim asylum in the UK, there is no time scale for them, at least since, I would say, 2019. They have to wait for a long time to receive any update about their asylum claim. They're not able to follow up their case. And they can wait for a few years or several years to get a status or any kind of result. Depression is, I'm pointing out to the mental health impact of being in this limbo and asylum system, how it can affect the function and the ability to integrate to the society, and how they can remain capable of being involved in their day-to-day action. And the third one was dehumanization. The view that some politicians and the government is showing to the public about asylum seekers and refugees is just dehumanizing and criminalizing them, and it has effect on them in a society.
We should, I think, dig into your experience a little bit more. How did you come to the UK, and how did you find the process of seeking asylum?
So I think my story is a little bit unique. I think each asylum seeker has a unique story of their own, unlike what some politicians want to say, that they are all the same. They're not. I came to the UK with a visa, and actually my situation has changed back home, which made me unable to go back. So I had to claim asylum, and I claimed asylum on September 2020. And I genuinely had no information about how the asylum system is working in the UK and what are the processes. And I have to say that my first encounter with the Home Office and the asylum system was not really pleasant. Since the day that I claimed asylum in the Home Office until a few weeks ago that I got my status. So it's unpredictable, it's unpleasant, and the things you hear, that the behavior that you receive is really disrespectful.
You talked about your first interaction as being something which triggered a lot of emotions for you. Could you talk in as general a terms as you like about what that first interaction was?
Yeah, but so my first interaction was with the immigration officer in the Home Office in Croydon, London. And so he was in complete disbelief. He didn't believe me. It was it wasn't questioning, it was interrogation mostly. And they talked to me in a way that, it's the same, like, we are sick of you. I know what you want, and etc. And I didn't find it pleasant because at that time I was really in distress and frustrated because of my situation. It wasn't easy for me to justify my position and explain my story. And I expected to receive some kind of sympathy and understanding so I can open up about my story. But yeah, that was the first encounter. And then after that, going to Napier Barracks and everything just showed me, if you think it's going to get better, it's not true. It's going to get worse.
So you have this initial meeting. What happens next?
So they take initial information and documents from you. They do an initial interview to get the basic information about personal information and the nature of your claim. And after that, they would ask if you need support of the government, I mean, financially and in regard to accommodation. So that's pretty much like this, but they don't provide information what's going to happen next. So you're completely uninformed about the next process. So that's also caused a great deal of stress and frustration because I didn't know what's going to happen next. Like, I had no idea where I'm going to go, when they're going to inform me about the next process and what's going to happen. So you're in complete ignorance, let's say. And I mean, I had the privilege to speak English. I mean, that paved my way to get information. But we have to consider that most of the asylum seekers are not capable of speaking another language. And that's even more stressful for them. And they are not able to get information or talk to solicitors and, I don't know, charity workers who can help them. And you just feel left out. You feel isolated.
Yeah. I can imagine. So you're in this position where you're in this state of limbo. And then, so you end up in Napier Barracks. How do you find yourself in Napier Barracks?
So yeah, once I claimed asylum, I was accommodated in an initial accommodation, which was a hotel in London for 3 weeks. And after 3 weeks, the reception of the hotel called me early in the morning. I think it was around 8 or 9. And they called me and said, pack your belongings. You are going to be transferred. And as I said, you don't have any information where you are going to go and what is going to be the destination, where is going to be the destination. And I was really concerned because of that, quite anxious. And once they called me that the taxi driver is here, I went out and I asked the driver where we are heading to, and he didn't respond to my question. I think he was concerned that if I realized I would resist going. And it was only on my way to Folkestone that I realized we were going to the Napier Barracks. And once we arrived in Napier, I was really shocked because, I mean, the facade of the camp is totally like prison. You are surrounded by barbed wire fences. It's military blocks. and with communal area, communal toilet and showers and dining room. And so the appearance, the facade of the camp was completely shocking for me. I remember that they gave me a form to sign. I think it was the agreement. Once you arrived in an accommodation, they give you an agreement to sign. And I was so shocked, and I couldn't believe that I'm here, that I was there. And I just signed the paper without reading it, although I could read English. But that was my state at that time. And then they showed me my space in a block. I cannot call it a room because it wasn't a room, actually. So in a block, there are two sites in one block. And each side accommodate around 13 to 14 asylum seekers, in total 28 people in each block. And those 28 people share two toilets and two showers in total. And each site has multiple spaces for 13 to 14 people. And each they are divided by wooden partitions, which are open from the top. So you are basically breathing the same air. And in it, that was also a shocking thing for me during the pandemic. And yeah, that was the whole situation. I can explain more about it.
It all sounds like an incredibly stressful and disorientating experience. What was it like during COVID? Because there was an outbreak in Napier Barracks at the time, wasn't there?
Yes. Well, we really expected to COVID that COVID would like spread like a wildfire in that accommodation, because there was no safety in regard to securing ourselves from any kind of disease, including COVID, in that accommodation. As I said, we were sharing the blocks with 28 people. We were sharing dining room with more than 100 people when we were having lunch or dinner or breakfast. And it was impossible to protect yourself during the pandemic. And I think it was in mid-January that a few residents in one of the blocks tested positive, and they had to put fences around that block to like isolate them from the rest of the population of the camp. And after 1 or 2 days, they removed the fences, and we asked them why you're doing this thing. And they said, we asked the camp manager, and he said, well, because the camp is like a big house, so people should be free inside of their own house. So they freed the infected ones, and after a week, half of the residents became infected, including me. But if you see that accommodation, if you go and visit that accommodation, you're gonna find that it's not possible to secure yourself from any kind of disease, including COVID. Even if you wear a mask or practice social distancing, COVID was not the only disease that was spread. We had scabies that was spreading through blocks, and we had one case of TB. And so it's really common for these kind of accommodations to see people becoming infected with various diseases.
How long were you in Napier Barracks for, and how did you eventually end up leaving?
So I was in Napier for more than 4 months, less than 5 months, I guess. So once I arrived in Napier, I was really shocked. So I called Migrant Help, that, are you aware of this kind of accommodation and its conditions? And do you know how long I'm going to stay here? And they told me quite confidently that you are going to be there for 1 month approximately. And I said, okay, I told myself, okay, that's only 1 month. I can bear it. It's fine. I should be patient. And after 1 month, I called them again and say, okay, there is no transfers from here to other places and people are stuck here. And they said, we have no information in regard to when you're going to move out, and it's up to the home office to decide. And we asked the manager and the staff in the camp, and they had no information as well. So we realized that there is no guarantee that you're going to be moved out from this place quicker. And so I tried to amuse myself, distract myself from being in Napier's by doing some different activities and reading books and etc. But after, I think it was after December, that the general mood in Napier, not only mine, but everyone's mood, went quite down. It deteriorated, the mental health of all the residents deteriorated, because it wasn't only about being transferred from Napier to other places. It was about the home office or the staff of the camp being irresponsive. So any kind of question we had, they had no information. So who has the information? If the home office has no information, if you don't have the information, who is able to respond to our questions? And that was quite frustrating, because we didn't know who is in charge. We didn't know who we can ask our questions from. And that caused a great deal of distress among residents. I decided to write a letter, and I wrote a letter from the residents of the camp to the public, to the people in the UK, and stating the situation and conditions in the camp and how we feel and how is it like living here, and that not everything you hear in the media and from politicians is true. And I collected 200 signatures. Although I was ill with COVID, and I remember that I was like collecting signatures from other people, other residents in the camp, and I could like share that letter in other platforms and on social media. And after that, campaigners and organizers and charity workers reached out to me, and I could make connection with so many different people. And I had by making connection with those people, I had a chance to talk to the then immigration chief inspector of immigration and explain the situation, who was investigating about the suitability of Napier Barracks as asylum accommodation. And that way, I also had a chance to talk to a public law solicitor, that they could sort out my transfer from not only mine, but most of the residents from the camp. So I was transferred from Napier on 8th of February.
8th of February.
2021.
So Irfan, you left Napier about a year ago in February, and I imagine have since been living somewhere else in the UK. What has that year been like from then until now?
So, when I was moved out from Napier Barracks, I was transferred to a hotel in London again. And I have to say that day that I was informed that I'm going to leave Napier, I was so joyful and happy. It was like being released from prison. And I remember that I was seeing people on the streets, children playing, cars and buildings, and it was really beautiful. I know it wasn't that long, like 4 months, it's not that long, but it was kind of the state you are living in, it's like deprivation and isolation. So yeah, I felt really happy leaving Napier, and then I was transferred to a hotel in London. And when I opened the door, that room, and I had like my private toilet and shower, that's like the basic need. And you have that like dignity, the basic dignity and decency, you have your privacy, you have your own clean bed. And that was really joyful having that. And I stayed in that hotel for 2 months. And after 2 months, I received a letter that I'm going to transfer to a dispersed accommodation, which is now my current accommodation in Plymouth. And I came here in mid-April, I guess. When I was moved here, my mental health was improved, because I mean, the people here, the connection that I could make here, the people here were really kind and supportive. The charities, the organizations who were supporting refugees and asylum seekers were really supportive. And I have to mention that also the city is beautiful, and it's quiet and comfortable. It continued for a couple of months like this, but then it was in mid-summer or late summer that my mental health deteriorated again. And it was mainly because I was in limbo, as I raised in the beginning of the interview. It's the limbo that really bothers asylum seekers in the system, because the Home Office is irresponsive. You don't know what's going to happen next, as I said before. And you don't know when this is going to end. And I was keep questioning myself, okay, this state seems indefinite. You are not able to work, you're not able to study, you're not able to integrate with the community, support yourself financially. I hear from people that like asylum seekers are relying on the financial support of the government, and that's not really good for the taxpayers' money. I understand their concern, but if the government let asylum seekers work, if they allow them, give the permission to work to them, they are quite capable of working and supporting themselves financially. I mean, I was a person who was capable of working. I know the language. I'm young, but my ability to work was restricted by the Home Office, so I had no choice but to rely on the financial support of the Home Office. So that is the condition that is always left out when politicians talk about the taxpayers' money.
And just maybe I can bring Joe in here to just clarify. So when Erfan talks about relying on the Home Office, not being able to work, could you just tell us like what support asylum seekers actually get and the rules about working for them?
When you claim asylum, you are entitled to asylum support if you would be destitute otherwise. So you're entitled to support in the form of accommodation and subsistence payments. But as Erfan says, you're not permitted to work. You're not permitted to study. You can do voluntary work. You can apply for the right to work after, I think, 6 months, possibly 12. But you're only then permitted to do work that's on the shortage occupation list, which is a very specific list of jobs. And if you're out in a fairly remote area, you probably don't have reasonable access to jobs anyway. Those subsistence payments are very low, and it depends a little bit on which type of accommodation you're in, but it would not be more than £36 a week on top of your accommodation. And that's supposed to cover all of your food, all of your travel costs, anything you need like phone credit. And so if people need to travel to see a lawyer, for example, that's very, very difficult because, as we all know, train fares are extremely expensive and buses can be very slow. But for some of the forms of accommodation, when you're getting food and board, you get less cash, but you also only have access to food at certain hours of the day. So if you have to travel a distance to see a lawyer and then come back, you might have to choose between seeing a lawyer and eating in that day.
Thanks, Jay. So you mentioned when you moved to Plymouth, there was a really supportive community. One thing which, you know, I was kind of curious about was how have you been able to stay in contact with sort of friends and family who maybe don't live in Plymouth, who maybe don't live in the UK? Were you able to retain contact even when you were being moved around all over the country?
My ability to communicate with my friends and family was restricted in Napier, mostly because first of all, I didn't want people to be concerned about my conditions in a place like Napier Barracks. And when I was talking to them, they could realize I'm not feeling good. And also, if it was a matter of video call, I didn't want to see the facade of the camp. But when I moved to Plymouth, I think, I could regain that kind of ability to speak to friends and etc. But I can understand it's quite hard for people to communicate with their friends when they are moving around the country.
One thing that you just said was very interesting. So you didn't want to let people know everything about your situation because they might worry about you.
Yes.
That must have been quite hard. Have you been able to talk to friends and family about your experience since?
Yes. I mean, when I was saying that, I was trying hard to cover up the fact that I was staying in an army camp. But after I was moved out and after I was recovered, I told them. And I just tried to show them, okay, that was really hard, but I survived it and it's fine now. And I didn't want them to feel worried and concerned. And at some point, I didn't want them to become frustrated of how I used to feel when I was there. So I told them eventually, and they were really supportive and kind. But those times were really hard for me to cover up the truth.
Yeah, do you feel like there was a bit, you felt a bit of pressure to put on a brave face in front of all of it?
Yes, yes. I remember I had a few friends, close friends, who I had like weekly video calls with them. And I resist doing that while I was in Napier. And they were always questioning why you are like ignoring us, and et cetera. And I had to ask the camp manager if he can lend me his room so I can stay there and do the video calls so they don't notice I'm in a communal area in the camp. And he agreed and I did that. But that was just once in 4 months. So, yeah.
That's so interesting. Why do you think you didn't want them to worry about you so much that you would sort of hide what room you were staying in?
I think, well, I mean, they don't know. They might, in their mind, they might exaggerate what is happening. I mean, the situation we were living in was quite bad. But, I mean, they might overthink about what my situation is and how I'm feeling. And I really don't want people to be concerned and worried about. I mean, the people, my friends and family members, I don't want them to be concerned about my conditions. And to be honest, I think people have their own concern and I don't want to bother people with my own issues. But yeah, that was, I think that's the problem that so many people had, not only me. They tried not to tell their family members and friends that they are in Napier Barracks because it showed how they are vulnerable and they're in a state of deprivation, let's say.
I wonder if, and correct me if this is the wrong interpretation, but not wanting to tell people might also be linked to feeling like there wasn't very much they could do about it and very much you could do about it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was in a powerless state. They were in a powerless state, so no one could do anything. And the Home Office, who could do who could do something, was irresponsive and not really willing to improve the situation. So I didn't see any point of letting my friends and family members know what is happening.
Yeah, and that sense of powerlessness, I think, goes back to what you were saying about limbo, depression and dehumanization all in one.
Yes, sir.
Thank you for sharing that, Irfan. I think that that's a really powerful insight. So what happens next? So this is in the summer of 2021. Where do we go from there?
So, I mean, at some point you always keep questioning yourself, okay, what is the next stage? What's going to happen? And I think this is the feeling that every asylum seeker has in the asylum system. And if you have a solicitor, you reach out to them and ask, okay, what is the, if there is an update and what's going to happen next? And they would definitely say the Home Office processing application has been slowed down because of the COVID and there is a backlog. And that adds to your frustration because, again, you are powerless. You can't do nothing. And I think, as I raised before, I think I was in a really not as bad, I mean, not really bad condition, as bad as other asylum seekers, because I could speak the language. So I could, like, make connection rapidly with my immigration solicitor, with my local MP, with organizers, campaigners, etc. And they really helped me in communicating with the Home Office. But this is not always the case. I mean, a case like me is really a minority, maybe not that much. But most of the people cannot speak the language. And even if they can speak the language, they are not familiar with the legislation, how the system works, and how they can reach out to people. So it's like you have no choice but to wait. I think my application was processed after 1 year and a half. And still, I consider myself lucky because there are people in the asylum system who are waiting, who have been waiting for 2 or 3 years or more, and there's still no update.
Yeah. And then, but you now have leave to remain. That's right, isn't it?
Yes, that's really, it's been a few weeks since I got my status and still it is joyful and relieving. I really hope that all the asylum seekers in the system can feel this kind of joy. Words cannot describe that happiness and joyfulness. I started calling all my friends, maybe 20 to 30 people, and I'll just tell them I got my status. And I remember that I was standing in the bus station and I was telling my friends I need someone to hug and there is no one here. That's the amount of happiness I had. But yeah, it was great. After waiting for 1 year and a half, and it was really distressing. And you know, my mood has changed significantly before getting the status and after getting the status. You just think it's only like kind of an immigration status that indicates what your future is going to be like. And yeah, that was a great feeling.
So Irfan, looking back, now that thankfully you have leave to remain, what would you say the positive and negative impacts the process has had on you are?
I really want to say all of it are negative impacts, but I have to really look for the positive impacts. But the negative impacts are destructive, especially for the mental health of the people inside the system. When I was in Napier, I witnessed a lot of, not a lot, a few, maybe three suicide attempts. So you should understand that these people came to the UK to seek safety, but how their mental health is affected, that they are willing to take their lives once they are here. So that shows the significance, the drastic danger of how the asylum system affecting the well-being and mental health of the people inside, and how it de-skilled people. So because when we are talking about limbo, we're talking about people who are professional, who are capable of working, and being in limbo for a few years is going to de-skill them. They are not able to gain experience, and once, hopefully, if they get a status, they have no experience at all working in a country like UK. And it also affects their ability to communicating with the public, with the society, finally integrating with the society, because eventually this is going to be their home. This country is going to be their home. And if they cannot find themselves able to communicate with the people outside, that is going to have an impact on themselves and their family members. The positive impact, I really have to think hard about it. Positive impact. But I think the positive impacts are that you come to the point, you come to the realization that that there are people who constantly wants for political purposes and aims wants to put you in a worse, even worse condition, in more painful condition, and you really have to fight back against that. And this is something that I myself, I encouraged other asylum seekers to do, and I myself did it. There is kind of a propaganda against asylum seekers and refugees. It has been for a long time. The hostile environment that we are seeing is not a consequence of 1 or 2 years policy making. It's the result of decades of spreading misinformation and disinformation about seekers and refugees. And I was in asylum system, and while I was in asylum system, I was trying hard to do campaigning, informing people, talking to journalists, and let them know what is it like being in the system. And I would receive calls from, for example, the camp manager and some other people to, like, victimizing me and scaring me and push me back from my activism. And I was quite stubborn in that regard. I didn't really notice what they wanted me to do, but I imagine that most of the asylum seekers do that. And I think the positive impact of it was it made me unable to raise my voice, because once you see the injustice and injustice and being powerless and voiceless, you realize that you have to do something for yourself. And I really encourage campaigners, organizers, and activists not to become disappointed, and also asylum seekers not to be afraid, because it's their right, and they have to raise their voice if they feel that they are being disrespected and criminalized.
Thanks, Erfan. Yeah, I think your positive point reminds me of something which you've sort of said throughout today, which is at several occasions in the process, obviously the situation for yourself has got very hard, but you wrote a letter on behalf of everybody in Napier Barracks. You've kind of constantly expressed a concern for people that don't speak English and are maybe finding the process harder. And you are quite active. You're an activist, I suppose. Would you say that, you know, organizing people and representing other people and, I suppose, trying to speak for people beyond just yourself is a way that has helped get you through this?
Yes, yes, exactly. It's, I mean, I was doing it for a purpose, to informing people and raise our voices as asylum seekers. I mean, it's a, we are a voiceless community. But also I tried to distract myself, because I knew if I remain quiet and silent, not only I'm encouraging those policymakers to criminalize asylum seekers, but also I'm putting myself in a quite depressing state, because you're not active, you're not doing anything. And I think asylum seekers must raise their voice, at least for the sake of their own well-being.
Thanks so much for sharing your story with us, Erfan. I will bring you back in a minute. For now, though, let's turn to Joe. So, Joe, just as a quick starter question, Erfan's shared quite a powerful story there. Do you have to hand any idea of the number of people going through that process as we speak?
Well, what we know is that last year there were about, in the year to September 2021, 37,000 new applications for asylum. That's main applicants. So some of those will also have dependents who are also on their way through the process. But, you know, Erfan talked about these huge delays. So the people in the asylum kind of caseload in a year is not just the people that applied that year. It will be all the people that applied in previous years and are still waiting, have been sort of put into limbo by those inadmissibility rules, or are waiting for an appeal hearing. And then, of course, all the people who are refused asylum, not necessarily because they don't have a genuine fear of going back, but all the people that are still caught up in that system and trying to get fresh claims in and new evidence together. So I don't have to hand a number of people, but it will be a lot of people.
Tens of thousands, yeah. Tens of thousands, yeah. If not more. Yeah, 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 yeah. So we've talked a lot about the asylum process. What other routes of immigration applications are there?
So there's a huge range of applications that you could make under the under the immigration rules, or under the Human Rights Act, for example. Most of them are outside the scope of legal aid. So people would be looking at paying for advice or relying on a very limited amount of free advice that's available. And within the sort of the protection category, that might be domestic violence, trafficking, but they have very specific definitions. You might also have a human rights application around Article 8, private and family life. So if it's, for example, you've been in the UK a long time, perhaps you've overstayed a visa or been refused asylum but never been removed, you might have a long-term partner, you might have children here. And so those people might be applying for leave to remain under the family part of the immigration rules. Now, first of all, you've got quite narrow criteria, but there are actually about 674,000 undocumented people in the UK. That's based on an estimate by a researcher called Andy Jolly in 2020. But we reckon about 60% of those people would potentially qualify for a grant of leave to remain. But if you manage to fit yourself into those narrow criteria, you then face a huge application fee. It's over £1,000 per person. So obviously in the asylum system, you don't have the application fee. On top of the application fee of over £1,000 per adult, you pay the immigration health surcharge, which is over £600 per year, and you pay that up front. You can apply for a fee waiver, but that's an enormously complicated application. You have to annotate all the bank statements, look at pay slips, tenancy agreements, a lot of detail. And if you succeed on that, you get 2.5 years of leave on a 10-year route to settlement. And usually that will have a condition attached that you have what they call no recourse to public funds. So that means no access to benefits, including in-work benefits. So things like tax credits to enable you to help get help with childcare to be able to get into work. Now, you can apply to have that lifted, but it's yet another application. And then you're faced with renewing that every 30 months with the same huge fee or fee waiver application. And it gets harder to get advice and representation after that first application. And you'll get that no recourse condition imposed again and have to apply again to have it lifted. And then this final fifth application for indefinite leave to remain. But there are no fee waivers for that. So you either get hold of the massive fee or you stay on that treadmill of applications every 30 months until you can get that money together. If you make one application late in that 10-year period, you go right back to the beginning of that 10-year route to settle.
So, Jo, you spent some time at the bar,
yes,
dealing in this kind of area. I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about what that was like, and in particular, what that was like emotionally, dealing with very challenging cases where there are more cases than you can really deal with.
Yeah, I think all asylum lawyers have a story or multiple stories of the case that almost broke me. And I would say we're all deeply aware that the primary trauma is of the people that we're representing. It's not ours. But you can't ignore the impact it has on you as a lawyer, because otherwise you're going to burn out and be no use to anyone. It was in many ways just the most brilliant job. And I remember my first ever asylum or immigration case was a bail application. And the client was a father of four, and we got him released on bail. And I felt like I could fly when I left that tribunal. It was brilliant to get someone out of detention. But it's a huge sense of responsibility. My case that almost broke me was a hunger strike case where my client was in immigration detention, a young woman, and her fiancé had been killed. She'd attempted suicide. And when that didn't work, she went on hunger strike because she would rather die than return. And the support group was calling me every day saying, if you don't get her out soon, she's going to die. And, you know, fair enough, because they needed me to act, but there was no more I could do in the circumstances to get the case into court. And there's this huge kind of sense of responsibility, because it is life or death in some cases, or it's freedom or detention, or it's life or torture. There was a young woman that I met face to face for the first time in the cells of the High Court, shaking with both the cold and fear. She'd been trafficked and there was a high risk of re-trafficking, and the Home Office wanted to return her to a country that has a very high asylum grant rate, let's say. It's somewhere that was quite dangerous. You know, a young man who arrived as a child who was so fragile, he'd attempted suicide a couple of times, and I knew he wouldn't cope if his appeal was refused. So there's the stress of that sense of responsibility to your clients, and then the urgency of a lot of it. So routinely, I would get papers the day before a hearing, have to work on them quite late after getting my children to bed, or get a tribunal decision. You have a very short deadline to appeal. And if your solicitor is working part time, then you as barrister might only get the papers with a day or two before the deadline. So you have to work on it into the night, but you have to get up in the morning for court. So you don't always get enough sleep to base all that on. And then if you're working on legal aid, especially as a junior barrister, you never know if you're going to have enough money to pay the mortgage. So it's a brilliant job, but at the same time, it's an incredibly stressful job. And often the Home Office's conduct of cases makes that worse. And sometimes the tribunal's handling of cases makes that worse. So one example of that was a client who had suffered horrendous abuse as a child from her own family, was very, very distressed. And when we went into the appeal hearing, the Home Office presenting officer persisted in questioning her in the most intrusive and aggressive way. And all of my objections to that were ignored by the judge. And I remember coming out of the hearing just feeling dirty, because I couldn't protect that young woman from this just abusive way of questioning. And it then took the judge a long time to produce a decision. And in the meantime, the client had attempted suicide. And as much as I'd tried to protect her, I felt I'd failed to protect her. And so you carry a huge amount of weight, while obviously recognizing that it's your clients that have really suffered. But I think there is much more awareness now of vicarious trauma for legal professionals, even than there was, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. And I think that that's really important, because you can't look after your clients without looking after yourself. But legal aid and the Home Office and the tribunal service all need to step up and play a part in that as well.
That's really powerful, Jo, and thank you for sharing that. I think while you say, you know, the trauma is obviously primarily people going through the system, you as somebody who is in a supporting role does have to take a position of responsibility. It's very hard work, and for young barristers the income stream is also very precarious. So
but I think that's that the case not only for barristers, but for all of those support organisations, you know, those that Irfan talked about that are going into NAPIER, that also have that feeling of awful helplessness and anger at what's going on and desperately wanting to help. You know, and all those caseworkers, particularly in those areas of legal aid shortage, where there's constantly cases that you have to turn away in order to be able to do the ones you've got properly. But then knowing that those are human beings that are not getting the help that they need. So it is very, very tough across the board. And the thing that's frustrating is that it really doesn't need to be that way.
So Irfan, just to return to you, we've talked about how difficult the system is and we've talked about how much it needs to change. But, you know, pessimistically, bearing in mind that it might not change for a while, do you have any advice for somebody going through the system right now?
I know it's hard to advise people who are struggling in the asylum system, giving a piece of advice, because they are really in a vulnerable position. But I would say be patient, but resistant. Just bear in mind that these days gonna pass, but don't let it affect you in a significant way. Try to resist by being active in your community, by raising awareness in society about yourself, about the asylum system and how the asylum system is affecting you, and just simply keep fighting and be patient. That's it.
Brilliant. Joe, have you got anything you'd like to add to that?
No, I can't imagine what it must be like to go through it. I think you've been incredible, Irfan. You have my absolute respect.
Well, thank you both so much for joining us on the second episode of Losing Myself, Mental Health in a Hostile Environment. I hope you have a brilliant day And hopefully speak to you soon.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us.
You have been listening to Losing Myself, Mental Health in a Hostile Environment. Today's show was brought to you by Migrants Organise and the Advocacy Project. Migrants Organise is a platform for refugees and migrants to organise for power, dignity and justice to enable meaningful inclusion and integration. They combine advice and support for individuals affected by the hostile environment immigration policy with community organising, advocacy, research and campaigning to dismantle structural racism. The Advocacy Project is a charity working to support some of London's most marginalised and excluded communities to have a voice, know their rights, and make choices about their lives. Speak Up Radio is a project run by the Advocacy Project, which plays music, chat, and information about rights, health, and well-being. We explore mental health, disability, and social care on air 24/7 and have live shows every week. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, please email in to speakup@advocacyproject.org.uk. This work has been supported by Imperial Health Charity.